Primary care knowledge boost. How general practice is funded. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Primary Care Knowledge Boost. Welcome back if you're a previous listener, and welcome if you're new to us, and so lovely to have you. Today, we are chatting all about funding in general practice with Dr. Tim Dalton, who is a GP in Wigan, and he's chair of the Greater Manchester Provider Board.
Yeah, he talks us through right from the beginning. So I profess my ignorance in terms of some of the ways in which the general practice is funded. So we start from how it's different to NHS, other NHS settings, where the money starts, where the money ends, the different kind of streams of money that flow into general practice in terms of some of the more nitty gritty, like the contracted lists and how it's kind of some payment per patient, then a bit more about enhanced services, things like DESs and LESs, and he'll explain what they are if you've never heard of them, and then QOF points as well. So it goes through all of that, and then we also talk a bit about PCNs, so primary care networks and federations, and where that all fits into the bigger picture. And then, as I'll say in my learning points later, there's a bit of explanation around GMS and PMS and APMS contracts, which we'll explain.
Yes, it was a fab episode. Kudos to Tim for agreeing to take this one on, and we hope you learn as much as we did.
I'm Dr. Tim Dalton. I'm a GP in Wigan and chair of the Greater Manchester GP Provider Board.
Lovely. So thank you very much for volunteering / being coaxed into doing this. It's generally to get a bit of an overview. So we're coming at it from a very zoomed out perspective. So it's all about trying to get an idea of how general practice is funded and sort of from the top down, really. So first of all, can you speak about why it's important for us in general practice to understand the flow of money through the system?
Yeah, no worries. So general practice is clearly part and heart of the NHS, but it's funded in a very different way to the rest of the NHS, with effectively a lot of very small independent GP practices who operate at a in a business-like manner and are paid on the basis of what they earn and what costs they incur, which then gives the partners an income rather than being a salary like most of the rest of the NHS works upon. It's unique. It's what's kept general practice being as innovative and reactive as the way it has been compared to maybe some of the parts of the NHS, but it does bring in its own challenges as well.
So if we start from the very beginning, can you give us an overview of where the money comes from, where the funding streams are, how general practice is structured in terms of its money?
No problem. So first and foremost, GPs are contracted to look after a so-called list of patients. They're patients living in a certain area, and we are contracted to deliver certain things for them. Primarily, we're contracted to be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is what the contract says. And for that, we're paid the princely sum of £104.73 per patient per year to provide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, unlimited access, which is not a terribly large sum of money. There's all sorts of complicating factors into what is a patient. There's something called a Cahill formula, which, so from my own personal practice, we have actually around 3,200 patients. But because we live in we work in a fairly deprived part of Greater Manchester, and we have quite a young population, but then there's quite a high practice turnover and we have quite a lot of nursing homes, we're paid for looking after around 3,400 patients because the Cahill formula accounts for those variabilities. And so that's what we get per year. However, then most practices in the country exercise what's called the opt-out option. So back in 2004, we were allowed to opt out of our so-called out-of-hours period, where we have to provide care Monday to Friday from 8 in the morning till 6:30 at night. And we can opt out of the out-of-hours period, so weekends, evenings and bank holidays. And for that, we give up 4.75%, or about a fiver, of that £104. So in reality, most practices get about £100 a year for providing that in hours, 8 till 6:30 cover.
Interesting.
So that's the core element of all GP surgeries. And for that, we provide care for people who are ill or people who believe themselves to be ill. That's roughly what the contract says. So that means it's primarily most sort of acute illnesses. It's really then elements of chronic illness, but only elements, and things like end-of-life care don't fall within that category. Things like a lot of the prevention work, various vaccinations and so on, are not things that people are ill or believe themselves to be ill. So in addition to the core contract, every GP contract then has a whole series of additional bits. And they're called enhanced services, and there's all sorts of acronyms here. So there's directed enhanced services, or local enhanced services, or DESIs and LESIs. And they start to specify what are the other things that we might be wanting to get GP surgeries to do. So the directed hand service are things like flu jabs or things like weight management. Recently, things like the COVID vaccination scheme was a big directed enhanced service where there was clearly a national enhanced need where we needed all GPs to do certain types of things. The local enhanced services are when either within your locality there's specific needs for certain either population cohorts or certain health inequalities around things like shared care or things like minor surgery or homelessness or quality improvement. And so commissioners negotiate with their local practices about we want you to focus on these particular elements and describe a local service which they want them to deliver, or a LES. And that gives those two give a second income stream for general practices. And then the third big core income stream is so-called the QOF, or Quality and Outcomes Framework. Now, this was devised again 20-odd years ago to recognise that we wanted GPs to look at far more than deal with people who were ill or believe themselves to be ill, and start to look at things like quality improvement around chronic disease management and a whole variety of things. Now, it's an annual contract which evolves and shapes. It started off 20 years ago about 8 things. It now has sort of 3 major elements, one around quality improvement, where we have to do some work looking at both our workforce and how do we optimise access for our patients and use various quality improvement methodologies around assessing what things are like, working out what would make it better, and then deliver a plan to make it better. There are a whole number of measures in relation to sort of public health, things like blood pressure, obesity, smears, vaccines. And then there are also some measures particularly around there's about 20 clinical areas from sort of diabetes, chronic kidney disease, asthma, serious mental illness, learning disability, depression. And each of those schemes has either a very outline, please can you have a register and look after the patient type of an outline, or has a much more detailed, very specific targets to chase, or say certain parameters of blood pressure to control within, say, like the CKD outline. There's specifics around having people on aspirin or a similar blood thinning medication, to have their blood pressure controlled well, to make sure they're not smoking and so forth. So there's a whole raft of those indicators. So on average, within the QOF, we get paid £213 for an average practice, and the average practice size is around 9,639 patients. What it means, though, therefore, the total sum that the practice receives is actually around £163 per patient per year to pay for everything. And I suppose if you put that into context of what if you were taking, you know, a pet to a vet, we all experience those bills, it is a considerably different number. And so it's quite remarkable value that GPs offer. And certainly, I suppose, the average across Greater Manchester in the last 12 months, GPs have offered 16.3 million appointments, or around 5.8 appointments per patient, or on average, therefore, about £28 an appointment.
5.8 appointments per patient?
Per patient per year, yeah. So it's a huge volume of work which is delivered incredibly cheaply and at tremendous value, and very different to how fees are paid in some other parts of the NHS. And this is part of the benefit that the NHS gets, that 90% of the contacts in the NHS are dealt with inside general practice at an astonishingly low price.
Yeah.
And for that, the GP surgery has to do everything for that patient. So it clearly has to provide the doctors and nurses. It needs the reception staff. It needs the premises. It needs the electric. It needs the phone, the postage, and everything there. The only thing we don't have to provide from that number is the medication issued to patients. So their prescriptions are separately funded. And there is some arrangements around the rent to make sure there is some support around that. But again, it depends on exactly what premises people are in as to what, whether that covers all of it or some of it. So that's roughly where things are as the average numbers.
Thank you. That was a really nice overview, actually, to start off. And it's generated a couple more questions for me, if that's okay. So you've got the core, the enhanced services and the QoF. Which of those are opt-in? Is there a choice in terms of what you can do?
So the core is mandatory. The enhanced services, both directed and local enhanced services, have to be offered to GPs, but the GPs have the right to opt out. For most of them, most GPs tend to opt in. And again, the QoF is offered to all practices, and most do it. Most do all parts of most of it. But again, there are sometimes local issues why some don't do certain parts of it.
Brilliant, thank you. And then just thinking about the actual stream of money and where it comes from, are you able to talk us through kind of where it starts off centrally and how it filters down to GP practices?
Sure. So NHS England has a contract with GP practices via the so-called ICB, or Integrated Care Board, which is the replacement for the last iteration of commissioners called CCGs, or Clinical Commissioning Groups. So we all have a contract with them. So the money comes nationally to the region. So in my case, it comes into Greater Manchester. And they then pay some of it directly to us as a practice. And things like the local enhanced service, they give out into what's called localities. And the localities then have a contract with us to provide the so-called LESs, or the local enhanced services, and that then comes to us that way. So those are the three routes it trickles down to us.
Brilliant. And sorry, Sarah, I've got one more question and then I'll let you come in. when we're talking about the LESs and that money coming to the locality, who makes the decision about what needs to be done to get that funding?
We have commissioners and providers in the NHS, although in an ICB world, we're meant to be much more integrated. So the commissioner looks at the needs of the population, works out for the population what they need, and works out a way of delivering it, of which general practice might be part of that solution, which then generates the contract called the LES, and therefore practices are told, please, could you do service X of certain standard, and that delivers the LES to us. Historically, commissioners did that in splendid isolation. More recently, we're doing it much more collaborative way, where practices, through their other big piece of work called primary care networks, where we work together on neighbourhood inequalities, start to work with commissioners to say, well, these are the issues that our neighbourhoods are talking to us about, and these are some of the things we think should be done, some of which might be around how can general practice offer different services, some might be how different people offer different services. And that then starts generating into a contract to practices.
Brill. So more of a conversation rather than a top-down approach.
Yeah, that's the ambition. And most places across the NHS are doing that. It is depends on the level of maturity across the whole of England. And this is just England, not more broadly.
We've mentioned the different income streams there. There's also terminology used around contracts. So GMS, PMS, APMS. Would you mind going over that and where that fits into funding?
No, absolutely. So the standard contract was a GMS, or General Medical Services contract, which, for those who can remember so far, used to be called funded by the Red Book. The general practice was in a bit of a mess in the late 90s, and so they invented something called PMS, or Personal Medical Services. Effectively, it was a local workaround of the national contract, which is not fit for purpose at that stage. The national contract got revised in 2004, and PMS largely disappeared over the following 5 or 10 years as it basically lined up with the national contract. GMS and PMS contracts are contracts in perpetuity, so unless the contract gets breached by either party, it just keeps rolling over. A more recent function, or a feature, sorry, has been what's called APMS, or Alternative Personal Medical Services contracts. These are where they are set up for a more finite period of time, often around 10 or 15 years. But if they were setting up a new practice these days, they tend to be set up as APMSs. And they're set on very much more commercial terms for a particular either population need or a particular service outcome. Providers are invited to bid and tender against those contracts, and they run for 10 or 15 years. At the end of that, the contract is then put out for re-procurement, which is very different to how a GMS or PMS, where I've worked in my own practice for 25 years, so I'm now looking after, as parents, the kids who started many years ago. APMS contracts tend not to have that longevity. So there's a patient sort of a prolonged relationship, but a different type of relationship with their practice.
Yeah.
Do you know what the division kind of proportionally is between kind of GMS and APMS at the minute?
Most are GMS or PMS. The most accurate numbers I can relate to is the Borough of Wigan, where I know best. I suppose there are 56 practices in Wigan, of which I think about 13 are APMS and the rest are GMS or PMS. So it's a significant majority, but there's a small minority. That does vary town to town, depending on what the history of the various places have been over the years.
I'll avoid making opinion comments, but it doesn't feel like a... I don't know. I guess there's pros and cons to that, isn't there?
Yeah, APMS contracts are really good. Bunch of GPs working in a really good way, but they are being contractually provided to deliver care in a different way to a GMS. From a patient perspective, most of what the experience is very similar, but the contract does force them to do things differently on occasions, and that's something which we just have to deal with as those practices. So the doctor and nurse you bump into, if you like, in the consultation room are going to give you great care. It's just the world they're operating in is marginally different.
Mm. So we've talked quite a bit there, Tim, about where the money comes in, and you have mentioned a little bit about what the expenditure is in general practice, but do you mind just kind of going through where the money gets spent in general practice?
Just to reiterate, so although there's an apparently large sum of money, that doesn't go to pay the doctors alone, so that has to pay for all that the doctor needs around them. So that might be clear the nursing team and nursing associates and so forth, paramedics or pharmacists. It then has to put into the reception team. It has to then do the making the premises run, because patients not unreasonably expect to have reasonable standard of premises around them. But then there's all the corporate and clinical governance that a practice has to have in place, so that the regulator is happy, for people like the Care Quality Commission or CQC. They expect us to operate in a certain way to certain standards, so we have to demonstrate good outcomes, have a look at our audit, look at our processes, and all that has to be funded from the same income stream. So although it sounds a big number, if you look at it in isolation, it actually is pretty hard and tight, and that's why, you know, with the cost of living crisis, where I'm not sure if it's political or not, but effectively general practice has been vastly underfunded compared to the rest of the NHS, there are significant now cost pressures in general practice, which why there are practices handing back their contracts, because they cannot make it run anymore. We have maybe squeezed too hard, but possibly I'm biased because I'm a GP.
I think that's a fair message. It's fair enough to say, definitely. So in terms of where PCNs fit in, so primary care networks, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, they're a more recent innovation. So historically, you know, GPs were set up as competition to each other. If I think back when I started, you know, we didn't talk to the GPs in the same building as each other.
Really?
We didn't have that communication. We were professionally courteous, but we were chasing the same population, look after them, if you like. It was slightly mad. And so over the years, GPs have recognised actually their peers not only are professionally courteous individuals, but they actually probably got some very good ideas we could borrow and steal from. And so relationships informally built. And primary care networks came into existence as a way of trying to formalise some of that, to get GPs in a room to compare practice, but also to get them to look at the patient, not just the patient in front of you in the consultation room, but the patient who's not in front of you. So our GPs work in very affluent areas, very deprived areas, very average areas, and all sorts. what we've been done is grouping together in so-called PCNs or primary care networks, which is groups of practices looking after around 30 to 50,000 people, approximately. Depends roughly where you are in the country as to how big they are, how rural you are, how built up and so forth. But that sort of size of patient population generally form into natural communities, natural neighbourhoods. And the idea is to get the GPs, yes, to look after the patients they are personally registered to look after, but to also help them engage into their neighbourhoods to understand the greater needs of that neighbourhood. But to do it collaboratively and look after the full 30, 50,000 population, as opposed to my 3,200 personal patients, is the idea behind that contract. So Primary Care Network came into existence, and we have a whole series of contracts now with some very specific functions for what they want us to do. So part of it is how we're encouraged and contracted to engage with those patients and communities. And by encouraging Primary Care Networks to engage, we start to understand what's the reason behind that, and therefore what's the community solution to that. We're absolutely, again, encouraged to collaborate together, both with GPs, but with broader primary care providers, so dentists, pharmacists, and optometrists, but also other providers, so community services, secondary care services, mental health services, but also the VCSE, so the voluntary communities and social enterprises, so charities, I suppose, in everyday language. So the groups within a community which actually people make a difference with and engage with, which might be a church, it might be a football club, it might be a scouts group, it might be all sorts of things, and it will vary on the community. But to get us engaged with that. And what we have to then do is start to listen to that engagement and then start to react and do stuff differently, and particularly start to work on reducing inequalities, looking at early cancer, and looking at how the population access us. And that's been a big priority of work. And then there are some specific bits and bobs around sort of medicines optimization or how we prescribe effectively, how we work with the care homes, so the nursing and care homes in the area as we cover, and how we use what's called social prescribing, which is it's getting away from a prescription pad into actually what does a patient want and need. So there's all sorts of much broader things that social prescribing gets you involved in, rather than a medication which you pop in your mouth once a day.
Yeah.
And how do PCNs fit in terms of the funding? Like, where does money come to make them survive?
Yeah, so a lot of funding which used to go to general practice now goes to general practice via its primary care network. So the contracts which I just described before start to have monies allocated to them. So we have some monies given to provide some basic and specific things. So we have monies to provide what's called a clinical director, so a boss, if you like, for the primary care network, some money to pay for that. There's some money just to pay for the basic funding of, you know, having staff and running and operating and so on. For things like enhanced access, again, if we hit certain standards, so we need to get around 90% of our patients to have access to a GP appointment within 2 weeks, is the current standard from memory. If we hit that target over a 12-month period, we get an amount of money. We are paid an additional premium to go into care homes once a week and visit care homes. There's an additional amount of money per patient inside the care home. There also are then some monies poured into employing specific members of additional staff. So there are so-called ARS roles. What these are, effectively, there's a whole bunch of roles been defined nationally. It should be really useful to work in general practice beyond doctors and nurses. So there's things like pharmacists or pharmacy technicians. There's a whole bunch of sort of physicians associates, nurse associates, GP assistants. Then things like paramedics, podiatrists, link workers, care coordinators, a bunch of social prescribing skilled members of staff. And also then some mental health workers of various bands and grades. So there is funding streams around that we can then deploy to deliver some of these schemes.
Yeah, brilliant. And our practice has changed dramatically from that, really. So what about federations? Are they similar to PCNs? Where do they fit into the sort of funding models?
So most federations tend to be owned by their member practices. So before primary care networks, practices needed a legal mechanism to start to come together to provide stuff, often initially around things like, say, out of hours or things where it needed to be at a bigger footprint than the level of individual practice, but actually more recently even at the level of an individual practice on occasions. And so they formed federations which operate in various legal forms, either as partnerships or limited companies. It provides a means for practices to start to provide services on their behalf. And so that's what federations are. Primary care networks, some of them operate as a federation. Some of the federations run primary care networks. Some areas they operate entirely separately. It again comes down to really what's been the historic precedent in an area and how GPs get on and make it work.
And then kind of just coming up finally, we've heard about a new potential contract in the works. Is there much to say about that? Do we know much about it at the minute?
Not very much. So the current contract we're in was a 5-year contract, which ends on the 31st of March 2024. And logically, you'd have described a new contract. That's not logic, and the NHS don't always apply. So at the moment, we have not a clue what's going to happen on the 1st of April. And so we're expecting the old contract simply to roll over a further 12 months, which I guess in an election year and financial challenges and cost of living and all those things is probably a reasonable expectation. But it makes it extremely challenging for providers because we don't quite know. Now, we know there'll be a need for GPs, and therefore, hopefully, that stability will be there.
Do they often leave it this close to the wire before they tell you what's happening? Really? Yeah. Wow.
It is relatively normal. And even when there's been significant change, it often does come out, not quite the night before, but within a week of it. I have some sympathy. It's complex. Yeah. There's all sorts of negotiation going in the background, but it is slightly frustrating, maybe is that the polite way of putting it.
And I guess as we're coming up to the end now, is there anything else that you wanted to highlight about GP funding or what we've been chatting about so far, anything that we've missed or you want to bring up?
Hopefully starts to spell out the complexity of it and therefore why GPs on occasions will ask for money up front. And if people are wanting something which is not covered by the contract, why there might be an ask for a fee. So say for a private fit note or something, that's why GPs will have to charge for that, because they need to get the money to provide the core NHS services. Most GPs, actually, it's a means to provide the care they want, and they almost prefer not to talk about it. And that's why we have excellent practice managers or practice finance leads who often deal with the complexities of this. And the vast majority of the GP workforce crack on with delivering great clinical patient care, which is what they really want to do.
That's really good. Yeah, makes sense entirely. Are there any additional sort of take-home points that you wanted to end on?
I suppose I'd maybe reiterate that general practice is an extremely hard working part of the NHS. We see the vast majority of the cases on a day-to-day basis. There is almost infinite flexibility, which is being sorely tested at the moment. So general practice is seeing a lot more than cases of face-to-face and online and digital things than they were pre-pandemic, and doing it with a smaller clinical workforce and doing it with less money than the rest of the NHS. So I think it does need some support, but equally what's really been helpful for general practice is the fact we are financially independent in this way, so it gives us fleet of foot to do things at pace, so that when we say had a COVID vaccination scheme came into existence back in the depths of December 2020, a vaccine became available within 4 weeks. There were thousands of GP surgeons up and down the country deploying vaccines at scale because of this independence and freedom they've got. And they used things like primary care networks and federations to help them, as well as their core clinical staff. So it's really complex general practice, but it really helps us to do what we're doing today. So we absolutely need to build and support it, but be careful we don't accidentally destroy it while we're doing that.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Tim. Yeah, it's wonderful.
All right, Sarah, so it's the next day. We've had time to ruminate on all of that information that Tim gave us yesterday. What do you think you took away from the chat?
Yeah, I think just off mic before we pressed record now, we were sort of going through and I was like, I just need to clear my head a little bit, because I thought it was really useful. I thought it was really interesting to understand the way money flows. I thought I understood it. I don't think I quite had. As I understood it, it's when he talked about the core contracts and the enhanced services and then QoF as the main points, and that some of that is sort of goes to general practice through in the integrated care board. But then you've got the areas like the locally enhanced services, which is held by localities. And that's the kind of, that was really interesting, that actually more locally needs and the important things can be decided within a locality, hopefully decided, and where to spend effort and spend money can be decided from there as well. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think I fully appreciated what like a DES and a LES were and the differences, and the fact that the that there is that option for local areas to base some of the work off need, which I really liked. And also the fact that you said that there is a bit of a change in culture to rather from that top down kind of approach to commissioning these kind of LESes and these services, to actually almost lobby, I guess, the localities to say, well, this is what we're seeing in our area. This is what we think the need is. This is what we think that the LES should be. And I think that collaborative way of working is probably a really good way forward.
Yeah, I guess it leaves room for a lot of flexibility and the pros and cons that comes with that, really. It is interesting. I really, we tried to keep everything as factual as possible, but it's really hard not to reflect on some of the ways in which things are done, like the APMS, the Alternative Provider Medical Services contracts, where things go out to tender and then they're reassessed after 10 to 15 years. I just thought that was interesting and possibly leaves quite a lot of room for difficult things. I found that fascinating as well.
Yeah, I agree, actually. I think it was really useful for him to cover where APMS sort of fits in. And I think from my perspective, I just think that there's a bit of an issue there with the short-term contracts making it quite challenging to be able to build those relationships from when someone's born to when they die, and with that good continuity, and it being a bit of an issue and a problem in being able to build a kind of a strong base of general practice with GPs that are really committed to their population. And I know that everyone working in the APMS contracts, clinical and non-clinical staff, are going to be excellent clinicians and really committed to looking after their patients. But there's just something about that long-term perspective that I think is missing in APMS contracts. And afterwards, actually, we did find out that it is possible for commissioners to give out new GMS contracts, so the long-term contracts, but a lot of commissioners don't actually realise that. So I think that's maybe worth raising or thinking about if you're in that sort of situation. And then it was, I think it was also really useful for him to talk about PCNs and where they fit into the funding sort of situation, because they're relatively new in the history of general practice, and I think it was helpful to know where the money flows in and out of there, and where they sit in the overall picture, really, as well.
Yeah, this is nearly like a historical record, really, of how the GP practices are funded at the moment, because it feels like there has been quite a lot of change, and I'm sure there will continue to be a fair amount of change. So it's interesting. I just hope it gets funded more appropriately. I think that's fair to say.
I think it is. Yes, I agree with you, Sarah, definitely. But yeah, hopefully you found it interesting and helpful as well. Bit of a different episode, but useful all the same. And if you want to get in touch, we'll put all the links in the episode description as usual. And again, thank you for everyone who continues to support us and get in touch. It's really lovely to hear from you.
Till next time.
On Primary Care Knowledge Boost.
This podcast has been able to continue to date due to the support of GP Excellence, Greater Manchester Integrated Care, and the Greater Manchester Training Hub.
Just a friendly reminder that these podcasts are for healthcare professional education and shouldn't be used for medical advice by the general public.
This episode was recorded in Greater Manchester in 2024. Guidelines can vary by location as well as over time, so always check for up-to-date local and national guidelines before making treatment decisions.
The content is based on our interviewees' opinion and interpretation of current best practice. It's your responsibility to use your clinical judgment before applying or relying on information solely from this podcast.
Check out the episode description for full details and any links we may have mentioned in the episode.